Matthew 22. I spent three of my growing up years in a home just off Big Timber Road in Elgin, Illinois. And at the time, I don't know about today, Big Timber was an apt name. There was a long, low-lying swath of woods that ran along the road. Perfect place if you're a 12-year-old boy, especially if you're a boy that somehow came across two or three steel-toothed animal traps that could be set in hopes of snaring a, I was hoping to get a rabbit or a squirrel or, wow, maybe even a raccoon. To set the trap required a bit of careful work. So you can envision me along Big Timber Road, laying the trap, opening its jaws, the tiny little traps, but putting leaves over it, camouflage in a way that would hopefully let a passing by animal not know they were there. I will have to say that I never caught anything, and for you animal lovers, you're probably quite glad. I did spend a carefree summer trying. Take a look at the text, Matthew 22, beginning verse 15. It opens with the Jewish religious leaders setting a far more sinister trap than mine. It's a trap of their own. You see the word there, entangle. Well, entangle is literally to trap one, to entrap one. The usage elsewhere is often legal in orientation. Entrapment in the sense of law courts. And so what you will see shortly is that their intention is to trap him or entangle him, notice, in his words, that by his own words he would have said something that unbeknownst to him incriminated him in one of two ways. But if you have been following along in the series on Matthew, you're probably by now ready to rehearse the times that you've seen this kind of growing repetition of theme. The religious leaders at work to entangle him in ways that would indict him. Take a look. It shows first in a direct way back in chapter 12 and verse 14. But the Pharisees went out and conspired against him how to destroy him. It took Matthew a while to put a word like that in his gospel, but there it is. The reader now knows that the religious establishment is against him. But this theme of their attempt to move him from the center is repeated. Take a look in 16:1. And the Pharisees and Sadducees came, and to test him, they asked him to show them a sign from heaven. Again, this testing, this repeated intent to take him away from the center of the people. But now it's beginning to escalate where we are in Matthew's gospel. Let me show you just a few instances. 19:3, the Pharisees came up to him and tested him on divorce at that point. Or 21 and verse 23, and when he gathered, entered the temple, the chief priests and elders of the people came up to him as he was teaching and said, by what authority are you doing these things? Or really the summary of it in verses 45 and 46, when the chief priests and Pharisees heard the parables, they perceived he was speaking about them. And although they were seeking to arrest him, they feared the crowds because they held him to be a prophet. Here you are now at 22. The tests continue. And there's an escalating nature to it. Not much of their direct opposition in the first 12 chapters. But then an initial word that he has those who are against him. The repetition of their rising up before him. And now a trap laid. to indict him. What's intriguing about the text is not so much their intention. You've seen that as the text has been unfolding. What's intriguing is the way that they try to ensnare him. Not their intention, but look at the bald-faced way they try to conceal it. I mean, this is their camouflage. Did you catch it? The camouflage of flattery. That's what I would call it. The leaves. The leaves are laid down, verse 16. And they sent their disciples to him, along with the Herodians, saying, "Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God truthfully, and you do not care about anyone's opinion, for you're not swayed by appearances." That is the camouflage of flattery. An effort to entrap him in his words, with words that in themselves are disingenuous. They're trying to make him feel as if there's nothing underneath foot. Well, what a duplicitous lot they were. But with that, the setting is complete. There it is. The trap is set by those whose words are as duplicitous as the best dressed camouflage. What is the trap? The trap itself is there. Verse 17. Take a look. "Tell us then what you think. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" What a great question. For a couple of reasons, but let me lay out the end game first. What made them think that this would do the trick? It's rather simple, logically. Think of it this way. If Jesus speaks against paying taxes, they would have ample cause to arrest him as an insurrectionist, one who was against the government, against Rome, and leading a rebellion. To speak against the tax is to move in this way. That said, turn it around the other way. If he tells them that they should pay the tax, well then, that puts him against the common man on the street who is fed up with the Roman taxes. So there it is. One question that would either put him behind bars or put him out of touch with the people. Either way, his influence diminished, which is really what they wanted to see happen. Think of it in regard to his own followers. I mean, you're reading Matthew's gospel. Who was Matthew? But the Levi of early goings, the tax collector. One of his own 12, was in bed with the Roman authorities for much of his life. He was the opportunistic capitalist. And we've already seen that Jesus saves even some of them. And yet, also among the 12 was Simon. And how does Matthew describe him in the calling of the 12? The zealot. The total other end of the spectrum. One who would do away with Roman rule. One who was looking for a Messiah before he met Jesus that would actually undo these very things. You can almost envision the question coming out. Tell us, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? And Matthew and Simon look at each other, poles within his own cohort, emblematic of the issue before them all. Not only that, there were certainly first century examples of insurrectionists. Take a look at Acts chapter 5, verse 36 and 37, just to get a sense of the time period in which this question would have been thrown on the table. Acts chapter 5, 36, "For before these days, Theudas rose up, claiming to be somebody, and a number of men, about 400, joined him. He was killed, and all who followed him were dispersed and came to nothing. After him, Judas the Galilean rose up in the days of the census and drew away some of the people after him. He too perished, and all who followed him were scattered." It was a day where people were rising up. Josephus, the Jewish historian, actually names one Theudas, who is decapitated after leading a rebellion of Jews who wanted to undo Roman rule. And he led them to the river and claimed to have miraculous power where he was going to release them from Rome. He didn't make it. The other one here, Judas the Galilean, you'll notice that it says in the days of the census. Well, the census would have been the moment where you had a poll tax or a head tax. Some of you went to the polls this week. I hope you did anyway. But going to the polls was a way of not only getting a head count in the country, it was a way of collecting the amount of money necessary that the state would put on each person. Even in Jewish history, in Exodus chapter 30, there was a head tax for every male over 20, half a shekel a year. Didn't matter how rich you were or how poor you were. It was simply a tax according to the census. There were those in Jesus' day that were rising up against Rome, tired of the beleaguering nature of the tax system. Insurrectionists. In Rome, the levying of taxes had a long history and an equally long history of resentment. When are your taxes due? Well, just a couple weeks from now. The resentment, though, in Rome must have been rising much greater than we have it in our own day, as beleaguered as we are. In Rome, the tax code, according to some, was as bewildering in its complicated system of direct and indirect taxes. I mean, sometimes they had to pay taxes in cash. Sometimes you paid taxes in kind. Sometimes you were taxed for various kinds of things, whether you owned a fish pond or not. There were special taxes levied on slave trade. There were taxes levied on customs. There were taxes levied on going over a bridge. There were taxes levied on how many axles were your goods that you carried. There was, of course, the annual head tax. Sounds a lot like Chicago, doesn't it? It's interesting to me, when you walk back into the biblical world, you end up at home, although the resentment level there was much greater than it is here. I was thinking of Chicago and our bewildering tax system, the endless number of taxes, and the things that I've become to think are taxes, even though they're just fees. All kinds of ways in which taxes are taken, all kinds of ways in which it opens the government to corruption, all kinds of ways in which it enables people to make opportunistic advances on the back of the common man. You know, the state sales tax here is 6.25%, but in Chicago, 9.5%. Highest in the country. Gasoline tax in the state, 39 cents on the gallon. Unless you're in Chicago, we'll add 5 to 6 cents over that. Tobacco tax, you want to buy your cigarettes, 98 cents on a pack anywhere in the state. Come to Chicago, we'll get an extra $2 on you on top of that. That's the moral tax, you know. There's a soda tax. There's a syrup tax in Chicago, 9% if you provide the syrup to a soda fountain. Property taxes. Do you know all the property taxes go to the municipalities themselves? They don't actually even go to the state. Imagine what it takes to run the machinery. And there's no end to the ways in which they will find their way into your wallet. There's a liquor tax. There's the vehicle registration fee, which I call a tax. There is the tollway tax, which just enables you to drive more quickly. The effect, is it rising within you at all? The effect is a certain sense of just being beleaguered. Now, ratchet that up 15, 20, 30 times over, and you begin to enter into the Roman world. You were tired of it. It was much more like December 16, 1773, when they threw all the tea into the harbor and said, enough. So the question is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not, was not academic. They knew they had hit on the nerve, which would put him behind bars, even if he enjoyed the populace of the people, or lessen his influence among them. That's the logic behind the question. And what are they hoping for? I think they're hoping for insurrection. I think they're really hoping for him to say, no, we're tired of the taxes. The reason is the Herodians. Do you see that phrase there? In other words, I think they had a priority of hopes. Certainly they wanted his influence diminished among the people, but what they really wanted was to do away with him forever, to take him off the scene, to allow their own work to return. You can see it there in verse 8:16. They were sent by their disciples along with the Herodians. Now, there's no other extant record yet that we've come along in regard to early source documents that mention the Herodians. There are the patrons of Herod, but the Herodians are, in a sense, blind to us. They're behind the veil, but it seems to be plausible to think that they were Jewish citizens who were sympathetic of Herod's rule. In other words, they were a religious constituency that had political access and gain. They, of all people, then, would have been looking for insurrection. A trap along Big Timber Road and in Matthew 23:22. A trap on taxation, which would have been more elevated, one of the more elevated issues of their day. Now, let's take a look at his tact. Verse 18. I love it, don't you, how Jesus lets them know that he sees through their own duplicity? I mean, listen to these words. They actually blow the cover of leaves away. They leave the trap bare. But Jesus, aware of their malice, said, "Why put me to the test, you hypocrites?" Exposing their heart. For the Pharisees were lovers of money. They wanted the money and the respect of the people. And so he shows their heart for what it is. And then look what he does in 19. After their cover is blown, he simply asks for a coin. "Show me the coin for the tax." And they brought him a denarius. A denarius would have been just a coin that was made of silver, or at least that was the base metal. I'm sure it was devalued over time and less silver went into the coin, but it was a silver coin. But it would have been the common currency of the day. It would have been, in a sense, like you having an Andrew Jackson in your wallet. You know, it would have felt like a $20 bill. It would have been something that was common currency that you saw often. We learn elsewhere that the denarius was, in a sense, a day's labor, a day at work. And so here it is. You can almost feel it in your pocket the way when you're in London and you can feel that size of a pound, all of its great distinct weight and feel. And they hand it to him. And he asks a question of his own. He said to them, "Whose likeness and inscription is this?" And upon their response, he's going to lower the boom. They say, "Caesar's." Then he said to them, "Therefore, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar, and to God the things that are God's." I imagine that the comma there after "Caesar's" would have been lengthy. "Well, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." What a master. He found really the only words that would both keep him from a charge of insurrection as well as keep him influential with the people. What a striking thing for him to say. And the results are powerful. Look, this is really what Matthew's driving at. When they heard it, they marveled and they left him and went away. Their carefree summer of trying to catch Jesus will go unheralded all the way through. Notice you're going to come upon it, verse 46 at the end of the chapter. No one was able to answer him a word. Not from that day did anyone dare to ask him any more questions. That's what Matthew's driving at. He's putting on display Jesus in the world in a way that both honors God and respects the civil authority to the point where he has all control over religious authority and in any other way. He is supreme. There's nobody like him. Not before or since. He cannot be entrapped. Which leads us to today. What are you to do with this? Well, first of all, you should ask yourself, what did Matthew want? The first readers or the first listeners, what did Jesus want from the listeners? And what did Matthew want from his readers? He wants you to know that Jesus has all authority. That's been the theme throughout the book as a whole, that God has given Jesus authority, all authority in heaven and on earth. And the primary movement of the application of the text is that you would recognize, again, in this situation, that he has real authority over all religious teaching. Nobody is his equal. Nobody on earth. And so I ask you this morning, are you merely wondering what kind of authority you're to give Jesus? Matthew has been clear throughout. You are to recognize that he's the one with all authority. Everyone at the end of the day will be silenced before him. And that even you and me, with all our questions of God, will on that day arrive and have no more questions to ask. Well, it seems to me that that's the first thing. What else for today? Well, I think we need to recognize that certainly Jesus wasn't merely doing all that he could to keep himself from being arrested. You're not supposed to read this text and go, yes, he's not going to get arrested. I mean, the whole point of the gospel is to indicate that he's moving toward arrest. So what does this text mean then when he sidesteps entrapment? It doesn't mean that he's trying to get away. He intends to be arrested, but not over money. That's his prerogative as the Lord and Christ, is to say, I will not go to a judgment of Rome and perhaps the sentence of death over what's going to catch up Theodos or Judas the Galilean or anyone else who thinks that I have come strictly for a material world view, that I'm here for an economic package, that I'm here to reorient the way the world works on money. No, he's very clear. I will not go under that charge. Which is instructive for us, because often we make the ministry of Jesus dominant foot falling on how he would reorchestrate the world of money. He simply says, hey, give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. Not worth my time. Not worth my money. Well, the giving of money. Jesus basically teaches us that he's come for something greater. Now, you're not going to really get that until you get to Matthew 26. And you should look at it this afternoon, 62 to 66. He finally will allow himself to fall into the hands of Rome and be put away from the populace of the people, but it's over the charge of whether or not he is the king, the Christ, the ruler, the one sent from God. blasphemy. Yes, he says, I'll go to the cross for that. I'll go to the cross that the world might know the reason for which I have come. God in the flesh with authority from heaven to forgive sins. But not over money, and certainly not over what you've got to pay on April 15th. Well, there's a lesson then for us by way of principle. Life is about more than money. Yet it takes almost all of our time, doesn't it? I think back earlier in Matthew, where Jesus teaches his disciples, you know, you can't serve them both. And in this text, in a sense, so give them both their due. Don't be anxious about what you're going to wear. God will provide. Doesn't he provide for the birds? Doesn't he think more highly of you than that? He will. There's an element here, even here in a text like this, where we learn to trust God. For Jesus himself has told us there's more to it than this. If you give yourself to God, or as he said earlier, seek first the kingdom of heaven, then all these things will be added to you. It doesn't mean that you'll get a second home. Doesn't it mean that the ski nautique is behind the corner for you? No. You'll have bread to eat, roof to sleep under, and life is a lot. Life is about more than trying to make all those other things work. What a relief. So give to Caesar what is Caesar's. Give to God what is God's. And as you give yourself to God and his kingdom and his righteousness, whatever you need is going to be added unto you. It's amazing to me how he pulls all of these things together in simple and profound ways. Well, Matthew 22, a trap set to remove Jesus from the scene with real application for you today. Give to Caesar what's Caesar's. But give to God what is rightly owed God. And he has given you your life. And he demands your soul. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you for this word, even as we now prepare for the Lord's table. And we think of all of what we're to give in life, and yet right before us, all that Jesus has given to us himself, who is life. So may we feast on him in thanksgiving through faith in Christ's name. Amen.